You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. It's award season, and again, the argument rages. Can you give the Most Valuable Player award to a player who had a great season but played on a bad team? Well, that was the case in 1987 when Hall of Famer Andre Dawson won it as a member of the last-place Chicago Cubs. But how it got to that point is a fascinating story. And here to tell it, the Hall of Famer, who struck 438 career homers, made 8 All-Star teams, and won 8 Gold Gloves. It's my pleasure to welcome Ted Randall's Talking Baseball, Andre Dawson. What a joy to have you. Thank you so much, Andre. 49 homers, 137 RBIs. Certainly qualifies for an MVP award in my book if you're playing, Andre, for a team on the moon, okay? I never got the argument against why players like you should be deprived of such an honor. What do you
think? Well, I'll tell you, I could have very easily won that award on 2 previous occasions playing up in Montreal, finishing runner-up once to Dale Murphy, and another time to Mike Schmidt when we actually beat Philadelphia out in the playoffs to advance. But, you know, the award is always going to be subject to debate. You can have a player of the year. You have a player of the year award. You have an MVP award. But I just think an MVP award should go to the player who was most valuable to the league, not just to a ball club per se, but who obviously made a huge impact and was a difference maker in the league itself.
It was a tremendous award, but thoroughly deserved that year. And as you say, we get into semantics about using the word valuable, but you should not be held responsible for the fact that the Cubs in 1987 were not a very good team.
Well, we had our ups and downs that year. I think, you know, the team right after the All-Star break started to dismantle. The front office started to go a different direction. We weren't that far from first place, but as a result, with the changes that were made the second half of the season, we took a dramatic slide in the standings itself and consequently finished in last place. But again, yeah, like you say, the player is not the one that's responsible for the outcome. The only thing you can do is go out there and play to the best of your ability, and whatever the outcome may be, it is what it is.
You had great, great seasons, but take a moment to talk about the specialness of the 1987 season for you.
Well, what I think really stood out for me was the fact that I was embraced by the fans from day one. Being a veteran, I really didn't have to feel my way around. I knew what, you know, was ahead of me. I put everything behind me, the collusion, the 10 years in Montreal. It was a new start for me. So I just, you know, wanted to play as best I could. Struggled a little bit at the outset, but as I mentioned, the fans made it so much easier for me to get my feet underneath me. They were salaaming in the outfield. You know, I heard rumors even before I signed with the Cubs. I shouldn't say rumors. I would hear things in the stands from the fans, such as, "We'd love to have you here. You know, you really enjoy Chicago." And I always did enjoy daytime baseball. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a no-brainer. I just, you know, I think I kind of tried to do a little bit too much early, but I can recall hitting the grand slam off Todd Worrell in St. Louis that kind of got me going. And from there, it just, you know, it was such an exciting season. Things started to happen on a daily basis. And as it turned out, by year's end, I had the best year of my career ever.
Skipping ahead, you went into the hall wearing an Expo cap on your plaque after having played 10 years there, but you said you would have preferred to have gone in as a Cub because, and this is a quote from you, "I never knew what it was like to be loved by a city until I arrived in Chicago."
Absolutely. The choice for me was not necessarily for the Chicago Cub organization, but for the Chicago Cub fans. Realizing that I had played 10 years in Montreal and only six in Chicago, I just think Chicago was what propelled me to that level, kind of, you know, got me going in the Hall of Fame direction. I left Montreal, you know, under bitter circumstances with the collusion and everything, and then, you know, being slapped in the face and even having management say that my career was over, my better days were behind me. You know, all of this kind of literally, you know, looked me in the face and say, well, wow, after 10 years, this is what they really think of me. So I was booed when I came back the following year as a Cub for whatever reasons. I don't think the fans, I think the fans bought into what the media was trying to portray. But I was the opposition at that point, and it really didn't matter. But when it came time, and I made it into the Hall of Fame to select the cap, I felt that I could sit down with the Hall of Fame and discuss this and literally get it resolved. But they put me in as an Expo because they were concerned about the history of the game. But for me, the main thing is I was able to accomplish that feat. I would have loved to have won the Cubs emblem because of the respect that the fans showed me, how they embraced me, and just the love affair that resulted.
Andre Dawson with us on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Let's get to the backstory about the lead-in to this fantastic year, the best year of your baseball life in 1987. Your last year in Montreal in 1986, 20 homers, 78 RBIs, .284, and the fine year, and the Expos try to get you to take a 17% pay cut from your $1.2 million salary, and they offer you $3 million over 3 years. But instead, you chose free agency. Now, this comes at a time in which the owners are engaging in collusion to artificially depress the marketplace, and they're later found guilty, and they have to pay $280 million in penalties to the players. But guys like yourself, Jack Morris, Tim Raines, can't find work. And you made the decision, enough is enough, we're going to leave Montreal. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I just, you know, failed at that point. I missed almost the entirety of the final month because of a hamstring injury. And then there were trade rumors, speculations that I will be dealt before I reach the 10-5 status. You know, which is, it's a part of the business aspect. Had no problem with that, but when it didn't occur and it seemed obvious that I would be a free agent and at least have the opportunity to renegotiate with Montreal, that didn't happen either. So it was the only point in time that I really had leverage. And the funny thing about it, the money was made available by the owner, Charles Bronfman, but the general manager, Murray Cook, at the time, you know, felt that they could go a different direction and I would have to be forced to re-sign because no one else was going to negotiate. I was willing at that point to take a cut in pay, but it wasn't going to be in Montreal. To me, the writing was on the wall. You got to move on. You got to move forward because returning, I knew I was going to be very bitter about circumstances and the outcome of certain things. So it was just obvious for me to move on. And the only way I felt that that could happen or would happen is if, you know, I take monetary issues, I take all of that out of the picture and just talk to a team who I felt I could draw, generate interest from, and then go somewhere where I wanted to play. There was only two places, one being Atlanta, the other being Chicago, obviously,
right,
because they were both still in the National League, grass surface, Chicago daytime baseball, Atlanta because it was closer to my home.
Right.
And I felt at that point I just, you know, wanted to move on, and I had the luxury of controlling my own destiny, but I couldn't bring money into the picture. And if I was going to take a cut in pay, it was going to be where I wanted to go.
And you decided, and before we get to that, I talked to Jack Morris once, and he told me the story, Andre, about how he went to Yankee Stadium to see George Steinbrenner. And he was in the same boat that you were at a time in which the Yankees were desperate for pitching. And my goodness, we're talking here about a guy who would eventually be called the pitcher of the 80s. The Yankees had no interest. Something was going on. And at some point, you and Dick Moss, your agent, recognized something's going on here.
Right. Well, I won't go as far as to say that the Yankees had no interest. I think their hands were tied. And, you know, they knew what they were up against, and that was collusion itself. The Cubs, I think they made me an offer to refuse. They made me an offer of $500,000 for a cry from the $1 million that Montreal was offering. And I just, you know, I felt that it was an offer for me to say, you know, thank you, but no thank you. Tim Raines was offered, I think, only $250,000. From San Diego, which he turned down. So I met with Dallas Green, and I gave him the blank contract, and I told him, you know, fill in, pay me what you think I'm worth, and you know, we'll move from there.
Yeah, let me walk it back if you wouldn't mind. You give Moss a list of teams. You mentioned the Atlanta Braves because they're close to your home in Florida. You mentioned the Cubs because it's daytime baseball, which you enjoy, and even the champion Mets, who had won in 1986. But because Moss lived on the West Coast, you made the Cubs spring training camp in Arizona your first stop, and already spring training is underway with games.
Right.
Okay, so you go in to this 45-minute meeting with Dallas Green, the general manager of the Chicago Cubs. Tell us what happens in the meeting.
Well, it was kind of unexpected with the media. They saw me walking around the headquarters itself, or the front office, and as you mentioned, games had already started, and the obvious sign was I was there, or I had signed to play with that organization, which really hadn't occurred yet. And we went into the meeting, and we gave Dallas the contract. Of course, he mentioned that he had never seen anything like it. He didn't know what kind of ploy it was on our part. He wanted his legal people to look it over, and then he gave us his, you know, words like he needed to give his young players an opportunity, a long look. He appreciated the fact that I was interested in playing as a Chicago Cub, but he couldn't make an offer to me at that point in time. He wanted his legal people to look it over. And I told him, fine, I said, but it's only going to be on the table for 24 hours, and then I'm going down to West Palm Beach to talk to the Braves.
You pushed
it. I got a call from him the following day, and he said, Andre, the best offer that we can make you is $500,000. And I said to him, I said, fine, it's not a problem. And he got quiet. I said, hello. I thought I had actually lost the call.
Yeah, he said, you didn't hear anything for like 15 or 20 seconds. Like, are you still there?
Yeah. He said, I'm here. Can I call you back in about an hour? And that's pretty much how it played out. He called me back in an hour, and he welcomed me aboard. And he said, take your time. I knew you was just out here. But as you mentioned, games had already started, and
right.
I told him, no, I was opening day game ready. I'd be back out the following day, and I went back out. I got out in time for the game, and believe it or not, I actually pinch hit in the game, and I got a base hit to right center field.
Who needs spring training? The story goes that in that meeting, which was lasting, as I mentioned, 45 minutes, you pushed a contract that you signed with no dollar figure across the table back to Dallas Green, and you told him, Dallas, you got 24 hours to fill in a salary figure of his choice. Dallas calls back within the 24 hours, and just for kicks, Andre, tosses out the $500,000 figure, And then in the conversation, without hesitation, he mentions $500,000, and you go, no problem. And then comes silence on the phone.
Exactly. And, well, to add to that, my agent, Richard Moss at the time, he did negotiate a few incentive clauses, which totaled another $200,000 of all that I reached. One being winning an MVP, making the All-Star team, winning a Gold Glove Award, and I think playing in 150 games.
Mm-hmm. Still much less than you were making the year before, $1.2 million in Montreal. Did it ever cross your mind that the collusion was such that with spring training games having already begun, never mind spring training having begun, did it ever cross your mind that I might never play again?
Not really. I threw out an observation. Well, I go to Japan, but my wife, she didn't take to that too well. She said, I'll see you when you get back. I just, you know, I knew worst case scenario, you know, Montreal would be there. But I also had it in mind that I'm not going to return to Montreal under no circumstances. But it never really entered my mind that I would never play the game again. I realized Tim Raines still was out there. Morris, as you said, was still out there. The only guy that really changed ball clubs at that time, Lance Parrish, you know, he left Detroit. But no, it never really entered my mind that I would never play the game again.
That experience, the bitterness that you experienced, maybe this is my word, not yours, betrayal that you had experienced in Montreal, do you think that was fuel for the season that you were to have in Chicago with the 49 homers and the 137 RBIs?
Well, I tell you what, I was very excited about, you know, my new surroundings, just the fact that I was playing in the States now. I was playing in you know, one of the major cities in all the sports. They had such a huge following. They had fans all around the country. And, you know, for me, it was the best option as opposed to maybe going to New York. So I was very excited. And like I said, I struggled for a couple of weeks. I had a very good spring, believe it or not, without having the first 10 days or so of spring training. And I thought that, you know, this is going to be a good year for me. I was very confident. And as I mentioned, you know, I struggled the first 2 weeks, but once I got going, it was, you know, everything just seemed to fall into place for me.
What an incredible year. And now everybody uses that season as the standard to award the Most Valuable Player Award to a team, to a player who may not have played on a team that succeeded on the field. Before you go, what are your plans for emerging out of the ivy in Wrigley Field again? Will we be seeing that?
Well, I haven't heard from State Farm. I think, you know, it's all behind us now. You know, we did that other part of it, as I mentioned last Friday evening, where I come out and I say, have the Cubs won yet? And Kerry Wood looks at me and he drops his hand and he says, no. Then I turned around and I went back in the ivy.
Right.
Thinking that, okay, all right, well, you know, I can't come out until the Cubs win. So now that they've won, I think it's all behind us now. But, man, what an outstanding World Series.
And you are a part of Cubs history now and forever.
Yeah, that's how I see it. I think everybody that ever put that uniform on, you know, they were on the edge of their seats watching Game 7. When they fell behind 3-1, they obviously looked like, you know, well, this is a young team and they are very promising. Maybe next year is going to be the year. But when they battled back and then they were winning Game 7 up by 4 runs and Cleveland came back and tied it. Of course, I think everybody that has ever worn that uniform or on the edge of their seats, hoping that the outcome would be a positive result, and then to have them win the World Series, man, what relief.
And how great of Rizzo to have said to Sandberg, Andre, after it was over, that they had won it for all that had come before them.
Well, I think all of those players there are aware of everything, the build-up, all of the speculation about why the organization has never won. This is a new generation. This is a young and exciting ball club, and they play the game. They have a leader that you know, he just pushes the envelope. You don't know what he's going to do, and he has a different confidence instilled in them, and it showed, obviously, the way they came back and won that series. So I think what Anthony was really trying to say was that, you know, this is for all you guys also.
How gracious. And how gracious of you to be on my show. Andre, best wishes. Thank you so much. And most importantly, good health to you.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, Ed.
So that'll do it for Andre Dawson and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.